It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. Today, Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Extension entomologist Donald Lewis will answer your questions about the plants and pests, or maybe they're really just little pals, in your life. Larder beetles are much more common than their name might imply, but no one has a larder anymore. At least we don't call it that. But most homes have larder beetles. So if they're not in the larder, where are they? You'll find out the answer to that poser, and we'll take your calls at 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Plants, insects, it's all part of Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa after the news. This is Talk of Iowa, and it's Horticulture Day. I'm Julie Englander. We're talking plants and insects. Our guests are Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. They're here to answer your questions about the plants and bugs in your life. Listeners, call in with your questions at 1-866-780-9100. That's 1-866-780-9100. Or email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Good morning, Richard and Donald. How are you today?
Good morning.
Doing great. Glad to be here.
Good, good. I mentioned in the promotion of the program about these larder beetles. What are they exactly? What do they look like, and why should we be concerned with them right now?
Well, let's take the last question first. The concern is that they are in the house, and we just don't like to share our living space with critters that are scavengers. The name larder beetle goes back to when we used to store dried meat in the cupboard, and the food supply was called your larder, I guess. And that's where these beetles first became a household pest, was in before the days of refrigeration. They would be in the stored dried and smoked meats that hung in the larder. Well, we don't have dried and meats hanging in our house anymore, but these beetles are still around. They are one of nature's amazing and abundant recyclers. They are ecologically beneficial because their job, their role out there in the natural ecosystem is to break down and digest animal proteins. And there's a lot of that laying around outside if you think about what happens to all the animals that don't make it and so forth. Well, in our houses, the animal protein that they find to recycle, the animal protein that these larder beetles find to break down for the ecosystem, are the dead box elder bugs, the dead lady beetles, the dead attic flies that are in the walls, in your wall voids, and in the attic of your house. So these natural recyclers find a niche in our houses, and because they live and work there, actually just an inch or so away from where we live, they show up occasionally. When you see the beetle, it's easy to identify. It's about 3/8 of an inch long, so it's a good-sized insect. It's long and narrow, fairly oblong-shaped. And the markings are best described to Iowans as being similar to a Hampshire hog. That means the insect is black on both ends, and there's a light-colored stripe in the middle. In this case, the stripe across the middle of the body of this hard-shelled beetle is tan. They're not black and white exactly like a Hampshire hog, but they have that same coloration of black, a tan-colored band, and then black again at the tail end. So it's one that most people recognize. Lots of people go through life and never see them, but enough of us are bothered, especially in the springtime when these things are becoming active, that it's a very common question for us beginning now and through the rest of the spring.
Okay. Is there anything we should do, or just kind of, they are natural recyclers, you said, so kind of maybe leave them alone, or what?
Well, that's a great attitude if you can maintain it as these things are crawling across your kitchen counter, and to dispatch the ones that come out in the open, sweep them up or throw them away, discard them is the logical thing to do. The difficulty is they are originating in a place that we cannot treat. We cannot get insecticides into the wall voids adequately to kill them. So we try to step back, seal up your house to keep out the lady beetles and the box elder bugs. Insecticides are not a good choice for this, but if you have to, you could spray the edges of the room where you see larder beetles. in an effort to try to slow down their emergence from the walls.
Okay. Well, it's good to know who they are and what they look like and that they're out there now. We'll go to our first callers here on Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day with Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. Ray in Mason City is joining us. Ray, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think it's probably a fir pine tree, you know, it's the flat leaf tree.
Okay.
And it, almost immediately as it came out of the ground, it's kind of like three suckers went up. And
okay.
It's been a nice tree. It's just, it's fairly tall now. But I noticed this year that over the winter, I've got two places where I would guess that it was rabbits, but they're from the ground to about a foot and a half, 2 feet, they stripped the bark.
Mm-hmm.
And it also looked like they did it on my house, which is barn board.
Hungry critters.
Yeah, so is there anything I should do to that fir tree to have to protect it? Or?
Well, at this point, I think the rabbits probably have caused the damage that they're going to cause. Now, the splitting of the trunk, where does this occur on the tree?
It's from the right at the where it enters or leaves the ground to about a foot and a half up.
But that, as far as the splitting, where you
the split
right.
is above that.
Okay.
But, and when it was young, the snow, those thing boughs would bend down, but now they're big enough and strong enough that they can hold the snow.
Okay, but the tree itself is how big overall?
I'd say it's probably 20 feet now tall.
Okay.
And it's still got all three of them are about the same height.
Okay.
I would say they're 9 inches or so in diameter.
Yeah, so you really can't do anything at this point. It's too late to get that down to just a single leader, because if you did, you'd really destroy the plant for the most part. So at this point, that's too late. You're going to have to live with it.
Yeah.
As far as the rabbit damage, I would wait and see just to make sure.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing you can do to repair the damage. You can't. But I would wait and see how the tree responds. If, in fact, the rabbits have girdled a branch, completely girdled it, where they've eaten the bark down to the wood all the way around that branch or trunk, if they've done that, then everything beyond that point will eventually die. Okay, that's unfortunate, but that's the case. So, but sometimes there may be a little bit of bark still there that you're not aware of. And so what I would do would be to wait and see. And
okay.
What's likely to happen is that even though a branch has been girdled, that it will still leaf out, put on or push out some new growth. But that only happens for a certain length of time. It can't sustain itself. And so that branch then dies eventually by mid to late summer. So if that happens, if it starts to grow and then you see it die, then you know that branch has been girdled. And it's going to die, and you might as well prune it off at that point. Hopefully, maybe the rabbits have girdled one of those, but maybe the other one is okay, and maybe the tree itself will survive. But wrapping it, for example, doesn't do any good. You know, wrapping the exposed area doesn't do any good. Putting on a pruning paint or any type of covering isn't going to help. So when they've basically chewed down to the wood, they've disconnected the top of the tree with the root system, and that's not a good thing.
Well, all of this damage is below where they split.
Yeah, so
it could be the whole tree.
Be the whole tree, unfortunately.
I know.
I think a lot of people.
One reason I think it's rabbits is because my dog heads over there right away.
Well, and you know, if it were rabbits, I would also expect to see rabbit feces in the area. That's usually a pretty. If they've been feeding there for a time, they usually do that. So, but I'm afraid that a lot of people, when they get outside this spring after being cooped inside all winter long, as they walk around their yard, I think they're going to see a lot of rabbit damage because in January and February.
They got very hungry.
They got very hungry, and snow had been on the ground since early December, and so they did cause a lot of damage. As we walk around campus here at Iowa State, it's very, very common, unfortunately. In the case of shrubs, they'll just send up new suckers, new shoots. They'll recover in a few years. But when it happens to trees, that's much more serious because they don't have the same power to recover from the damage.
Well, I haven't looked at it yet, but another place my dog heads for right away is, I think it's a spruce tree by my driveway.
So it might be the same thing.
Yeah, and I haven't looked underneath to see if they have attacked it.
Well,
and that's that one's probably 30 feet high.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Probably not as much of a rabbits tend to attack smaller things because a smaller tree has a thin layer of bark, and they're really after the tissue beneath the bark, the cambium and that tissue there. But when you have a larger woody tree, the bark layer gets to be quite thick. It may be maybe an inch thick, and they just can't chew all the way through. They just don't typically do that. So they typically go after things that young or have a thin layer of bark. That way they can chew through it.
Well, I think they might have gone under that tree, too, for protection, you know, from the weather.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ray.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, sorry for your tree. Good luck. Hope it can work out, but it doesn't sound like it's going to. We'll go to Sharon in Johnston right now before the break. Sharon, welcome to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day. What's your question?
Well, Johnston is offering a tree program this spring, and two of the trees they're offering is a pagoda dogwood and a trident maple. And I was wondering if I could get some information on, like, height, widths, and growing conditions, and any problems.
Well, the pagoda dogwood I would classify as a large shrub or a small tree, which means it can get to be like 15 to 20 feet tall. Mm-hmm. It tends to be just as wide as it is tall. It has horizontal branching, so that's very distinctive. It has white flowers in the spring, followed by berry-like fruit, which go from green to red to blue-black. And then in the fall, it can have kind of reddish-purple fall color. The pagoda dogwood does best in partial shade. It doesn't want full sun, definitely not. It's more of an understory-type plant, and so we would typically plant this where it might get maybe 4 or 5 hours of sun, and try to choose a partially shaded site with a moist, well-drained soil. This plant does not like hot, dry situations. It does not like full sun. So kind of a partial shade, moist, well-drained soil.
Would that be like on the west side of my house where it wouldn't get the sun in the morning, but it would in the afternoon in between two houses?
An east site would be better than a west site because the west site is much warmer than an east site. So.
Okay.
We're going to have to take a break. Thanks for your question, Sharon. We appreciate it. You're listening to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, and we'll come back with Extension Horticulturist Richard Geron and Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis. They'll be here to answer your questions about plants and insects. Call in at 1-866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Horticulture Day. I'm Julie Englander, and Extension Horticulturist Richard Geron and Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis are here to answer your questions about the plants you want to grow or grow better and the insects you want to befriend or bedevil. Call in at 1-866-780-9100, or you can email us, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org.
I should finish on the trees that she mentioned. Also, the trident maple is kind of a large shrub. Small tree, and we typically plant it more for the fall foliage, kind of colorful, nice fall foliage. Again, probably maybe 4 or 5, 6 hours of sun would be a good place for it, kind of a sheltered location for it.
Okay. All right. That's for the pagoda tree and the dogwood.
Trident maple.
Trident maple. Okay. Trident maple. We have caller here, Cliff from Davenport's on the line. Cliff, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Thank you. I have a wellhead that has become covered by some cedar trees that were planted as a windbreak. And I was talking to the plumber who takes care of my well, and he said that the trees would be okay to stay where they're at, but I need to trim them aggressively around the bottom so that if he ever does have to pull the well, he can back up to it with his tower. I'm wondering when is a good time to do that, and how aggressively I can trim those larger branches at the bottom so he can get in there.
Well, you can do that any time. It doesn't really matter. Any time in the next few weeks would be fine. But when you prune something like a cedar or a juniper, realize that if you prune off all the foliage of a branch where you have just a bare branch, then that's basically it. It's not going to leaf out again. So if you need to do that type of pruning, I would prune the entire branch off back to the trunk.
Very good. That's what I needed to know.
Okay.
Thanks for calling,
Thank
Cliff. You. Yeah, we appreciate it. We have an email here from Jeff in Rock Island, Illinois. He says, every year I like to take a pest control spray around the house, outside of my house, spraying where the foundation meets the ground. I also do this for the garage and tool shed. I was wondering if there are better sprays than others for this purpose. It isn't for any specific pest, just a measure to keep the bugs away so they don't want to make themselves cozy around the area, I guess. Is there a type you would recommend?
No, there's not one that's out there that would be better than all the others. There's a large number of insecticides that are all closely related, and the way we tell them is the chemical name, the little fine print next to the active ingredient statement, the chemical name ends with the suffix THRIN. And that suffix tells us that they are synthetic pyrethroids. We expect them to last 30 to 90 days. Apply them according to label directions. You know, this is one of those things that people get in the habit of doing, and it may not be paying very well, but when the ants are invading my kitchen, that's what I grab is one of these synthetic pyrethroids to try to treat that junction between the foundation and the siding. Even though I know that what hits the concrete blocks of my foundation, the insecticide that I put on the foundation, is not going to last very long because the concrete is basic and it breaks down those molecules. What lands on the ground may be absorbed into wood chips and so forth, where it's also not going to be very effective. So this is one of those things that we may not get as much bang for our buck as we think we are, but certainly targeting cracks and gaps where insects can invade can be done with these household sprays. Several of the home defense type of products come in a gallon sprayer where it's pre-diluted. You don't add water. You just apply it the way it comes. It's ready to use. Even comes with its own little applicator to help treat these cracks and gaps where the insects might invade.
Okay. And this is also a time of year ants are in the house resuming activity after they're waking up from their winter nap. So is this something similar to use or not? Or what would you suggest for that?
Ants in the house at this time of the year are one of the toughest questions to try to deal with because they aren't really fully active yet. There's some early movers and shakers that have woken up from the winter slumber. They got warm enough. They've got spring fever. They got wanderlust. And here come two of them trucking across the kitchen counter. What are you going to do with two ants? They're not hungry enough to take back bait. They're not, it doesn't justify using an insecticide, but you're still steaming mad and stomping your feet and feeling like you have to do something. And so these same home defense products that are ready to use that are labeled for inside the house can be applied at gaps along the edge of the wall and around the windowsills and so forth if you feel you absolutely have to do something. These insecticides will work much, much better when the temperatures get warm and when the ants become much, much more active than these early invaders are right now. And at that time, we'll also have a good use for our insecticide baits, our ant baits. Until then, it's probably more practical to practice the Richard Giron finger and thumb method that he keeps demonstrating.
Yes, I do.
He keeps giving me the motion that this is what you do with them. You just squeeze them. And when you've only got a couple, that's probably the practical answer for now. When it gets worse a little later in the summer, the insecticides will be much more effective.
Okay. Well, let's move on from there. We'll go to Kitta. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, in Iowa City. Hello?
Kitta?
Kitta, I'm sorry. Yes. Kitta, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Thank you. I have a question about squash bugs. I fight squash bugs every year. They seem to go for the pumpkins first and then the zucchini.
Mm-hmm.
I've used dusts that seem to work pretty well, but I feel like I have to do it 2-3 times a week, mm-hmm. And I'm not comfortable putting that many chemicals on. I'm just wondering, is there anything different that's more organic or anything that I can do to the soil before I actually plant?
There is nothing in the soil, nothing to do to the soil, because the squash bugs invade from wherever they are hiding right now. They have moved into the wood pile or under the loose bark of dead trees to spend the winter. They're kind of slow to get there, and they kind of wait for the pumpkins to grow up, and then they come back and lay their eggs on the undersides of the leaf. So step one, you could make it your hobby to turn over pumpkin leaves beginning toward the end of June, looking for these masses of brick red legs, eggs on the undersides of the leaves, and squash the eggs by hand. The second thing is, when those eggs hatch, there will be more squash bugs on the underside of the foliage than on the top, so your dust is not hitting them. And so I would
say, I actually do turn over the leaves.
You're
my dad taught me that, yeah.
Yeah, pretty effective at that. I still think sprays might be a little more effective than dusts at coating and controlling these sap-feeding insects. They don't spend a lot of time walking around to come in contact with your insecticide, so
okay.
You do a better job if you hit them directly. So number two on my list is thorough job, undersides of the leaves, and start earlier than what you have in the past, and then just keep inspecting. An organic treatment that you might try that will be effective against very small squash bugs is the insecticide called Neem, N-E-E-M. Neem is an organic spray that comes from the neem trees of India. It's an extract of the seeds that works as an insect growth regulator. And you'll find this in the garden centers, but you're going to have to read the little tiny fine print to find that name. But it's an organic alternative to 7 and bifenthrin and permethrin and the others that we would typically use in this way. But, again, it will only work on the small squash bugs. By the time they're a half inch long, this insecticide will not work at all. Traditional insecticides work very poorly. They get much larger than that, and the only thing that's going to control them is a hammer.
Mm. Oh, dear.
Okay. Oh, dear. All right.
All right. Well, thanks for calling,
Keita.
Good luck. We're going to be coming up on a break here. We have we'll be taking calls after the break, just so people know that. We have an email. We built a house last fall. Now half of our yard is snow and the other half is mud. I understand that August and September are an ideal time to sow grass. What can I do between now and then?
What I'd probably do is go ahead and try to establish a lawn this spring. And you can actually go out and buy a starter fertilizer that contains a pre-emergent herbicide that you can apply that will allow the grass seeds to germinate but prevent crabgrass and some other weeds from coming up. That's the biggest problem when you try to sow grass seed in the spring, is a lot of weeds tend to come up. So if you do it this spring, apply a starter lawn fertilizer that contains a pre-emergent herbicide that does not affect the germination of turf grass seed. And look for that at your garden center and try to sow your grass seed typically around mid-April, if you can, in Iowa. And then keep the seed bed moist and it should come up and hopefully you get a good stand.
Okay, we thank Ralph from Carroll, Iowa for that question. Now we'll be taking your questions when we come back from a five-minute break. Horticulture Day continues. Extension Horticulturist Richard Duran and Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis will be here to take your questions. Call in at 1-866-780-9100. We'll be back after 5 minutes. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Horticulture Day. I'm Julie Englander, and Extension Horticulturist Richard Duran and Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis are here to answer your questions about plants and insects. Call in at 1-866-780-9100, or you can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'll go right to the phones. Jim in Guttenberg is on the line. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for taking my call. While I was waiting, a few other questions came up. But anyway, I'm calling about when the snow melted, we have a lot of mold damage in our lawn. I know you've talked about this before, but I didn't get all the details of it. And then I have another question about those trees that invade your shrub and you cut them off, and and they keep growing back. And is there what is a good thing to use on that? And finally, when is the best time to treat Creeping Charlie this spring?
Well, as far as a little animal, we have these mouse-like creatures, the voles. And when the snow melts, we oftentimes see these little runs or tunnels through the yard in the grass. And as far as the damage to the grass, it's minor. I wouldn't worry about it. I would check, though, maybe if we have small trees, I would check them because sometimes they'll feed on the bark. And just like the rabbit, they may actually girdle a young tree. So check out your young trees to see if they've damaged any of those. But as far as turf damage, we don't worry about that. As far as when to treat ground ivy in the spring, the best time to treat ground ivy or Creeping Charlie is in the fall, typically late September, October. As far as doing it in the spring, the best time would be to treat it basically as the plants begin to bloom, when they're starting to bloom. They have kind of a bluish or purplish flower, and so when you see the plant starting to bloom, that would be the best time to actually spray the ground ivy or Creeping Charlie. And the third question was?
The trees that keep invading your shrubs, you keep cutting them off and they keep growing back?
Yeah. For those, what I would suggest is just let those volunteer trees leaf out this spring and then go out once they've leafed out and cut them off with a pruning shears, whatever, and then immediately apply Roundup to the cut surface, and just make sure you don't get it on the shrub itself, just the volunteer trees. And to do that, you might use like a foam type paintbrush and then just dip that in the Roundup and then dab it on the cut surface. But make sure you just get it on the cut surface, but that should work.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
We appreciate the questions. We'll go next to Ellen in Cedar Rapids. Ellen, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm asking a repeat question. I know that you've talked about pruning grapevines before, but I was in the car and I couldn't write it all down. So I need to know how to prune my grapevines. I only have three plants. We're not talking about a vineyard or anything.
Okay.
And I'm going to take this off the air so I can write it down.
Before you go, though, what are they growing on?
A trellis. It's a wooden frame and it has like chain link going up the trellis.
Okay. So do you have like No, I know
what you're thinking, and no, I don't have that.
Okay, so do all the vines grow at the top of the fence then? Is that
yes, they just grow up the fence.
Okay. okay, well.
So can I hang up and write now, or do you still need me?
Yep. Okay. Get ready. Find a big sheet of paper, because I tell you,
really big.
Every time grape pruning comes up, it's like 2 pages later, you're still trying to figure out which one did I cut again and why do I have to count the buds? And
well, to begin with, typically if you have a really vigorous grapevine, it may have 250 to 300 buds that are capable of producing fruit. And that's way, way too many for the plant. If we leave them all on, there's going to be so many grape clusters, they're not going to ripen evenly, so it's going to be a mess. So that's why we have to prune them. And they only produce fruit, on the previous year's growth, last year's growth. Older wood does not produce any berries. So we have to prune them, and they only produce fruit on last year's growth. Now, we typically grow these on some type of trellis or support system. And what we want to do is we count the buds, because let's say we have a really, really vigorous vine. We're going to remove most of the last year's growth. We're going to leave at most, just 60 buds, at most, okay? On the other hand, let's say we have a vine that's just not growing very well. It isn't very vigorous. Then in that case, we might leave just 30 or 40, just because it's just not a very vigorous plant. So we might have 30 or 40. We might have as many as 60. So if you have some type of support, what you need to do is go out there and maybe take some ribbon with you or something like that, or yarn, something very brightly colored. And let's say you have the vines growing on top of a fence, just on the very top. then what I would do in that situation is I would select four vines, okay, four, two going in each direction. And I would put a piece of ribbon around those that I want to keep, and the rest of them come off completely, totally.
Whack them away.
Just prune them off.
Wow, that sounds severe.
Okay. And then what you would do is take two of those four vines, one going in each direction, and you would cut those back to just one or two buds. And what they're going to do is they're going to produce the vines for next year's crop. So they're just basically vegetative. That's their purpose in life, okay? And then the other two, you're going to cut back, and they're going to be the fruiting canes. And so if you have a really, really, really vigorous plant, you can maybe leave like maybe 15 to 20 buds possibly. Well, somewhere in that range. But the total should be no more than 60. So 15 is probably a good thing, or maybe somewhere in that range. So
it's never easy, is it?
No, it's not.
What a process.
And grapes look terrible when this is done. I mean, when you think about, oh, I've got this thing that's providing some privacy along the edge of my fence or something. When you see grapes growing in a vineyard, the vines really look, well, let's use the word butchered for a better
Well,
term.
You're removing the vast majority of the material, but you're trying to maximize production. If you're not trying to maximize production, you can really let them grow if you're growing them more for an ornamental. But if you're growing them basically for production, you just have to prune off most of that old wood.
Well, that's quite a process. Well, but people can read about it, I suppose.
Right. We have publications on pruning. There's different ways of pruning them. We have like the 4-cane Niffen system, the 6-cane Niffen system. I mean,
All right. Well, we'll move on here to other callers. Joyce in Waterloo is with us. Joyce, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We live out in the country in a rather old farmhouse with its got two floors, so there's a downstairs, a basement, downstairs and an upstairs. And we are having a massive problem with ladybugs and flies in the winter. They've never seemed to, we have an exterminator that comes once a month to check, to spray and check for, rodents and things. And he has sprayed, and I must have swept up over 300 or 400 flies and ladybugs. Within an hour, we were back up to 50, flying around or dead. And every day, it's the same thing. Especially upstairs in one of the bedrooms, we can't turn on the light with, flies not go, everywhere. And it's really a bad problem, and especially this year. And I don't know if there's something I thought maybe coming from the walls or what, but since we have an exterminator, I'm really beside myself and don't know where to turn, so I decided to call.
Well, thank you for your call, because this is the very common question right now at this time of the year, and it harkens back to my childhood. I lived in a two-story farmhouse out in the open up on high ground, and I thought everybody had attic flies, and when I went away to college, I found not everybody knew what I was talking about. Well, the two insects you're talking about, attic flies and multicolored Asian lady beetles, are both outdoor insects that spend the summer outside in the county somewhere. And in the fall of the year, when the days get short, they are attracted to those houses that sit out in the open on high ground. And your farmhouse is exactly the type of place where they're going to be attracted, where they land on the siding of the house in late September, early October, and when the sun goes down and they get cold, they crawl into the wall voids or into the attic to spend the winter. Many of them have already perished by now, but those that were in hibernation and survived have spring fever, and they're ready to get back outside, and that happens when the heat from the furnace and the heat from the sun warms their little hiding place, the hollow space inside the wall, to be active, to be warm enough for them to be active, and they just crawl around until they find an opening around the electrical outlets, the switch plates, the gaps around the windows, the window frames, and so forth, and they come out. None of them have reproduced. None of them have eaten anything. None of them have done anything inside your house except wait from October till spring. And at this point in the year, sucking them up with the vacuum cleaner is actually the practical solution. But unfortunately, it becomes your full-time hobby, doesn't it,
right.
to keep ahead of them. Spraying doesn't kill them until they come out in the open. And when they come out in the open, you might as well suck them up with the vacuum cleaner as use an insecticide. But that's what some people do, is they spray the edges of the room. They spray the gaps in the around the moldings of the windows. If there's any place in the around the window frames, you can get insecticide in. That sometimes helps, but they still have to come out before they die. So, number one, you've got the exact right place where you're going to have the worst problem. Number two, it varies greatly from year to year. And yes, this was a bad year. We don't know what it's going to be like in 2010, but could be better, could be worse, could be the same. Number three, sealing up cracks and gaps is a great easy thing for me to say. But even brand new energy efficient houses are still going to have that. But this summer, any gaps you can seal between the foundation and the siding, any gaps around the window frames, any gaps up between the siding and the eaves, what can we do to seal it up to keep them out? If you see them on the outside of your house, your exterminator could spray the outside of your house in October to try to keep them from getting into the wall voids. Those that get into the wall voids are pretty much beyond reach, and you're going to suck those up the following spring.
Yeah.
So,
there's nothing else to do but that.
No easy answer, and if I can come up with a miracle solution, I can retire very rich, because this is just such a common problem, especially in older, tall houses that are out in the open on high ground.
Thanks, Joyce.
Thank you very much for your answer.
Good luck. We appreciate the call very much, because a lot of people obviously have this problem or could. We'll go next to Doug in North Liberty. Welcome to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day. Doug, what's your question?
Good morning.
Good morning.
A few years back, I bought some red twig dogwoods at the end of the season that were on clearance at one of my local nurseries. Stuck them in the ground in what I call a transplant bed. A couple years later now, they're pretty established, but they're not really where I want them to be. What do I really need to do to, I want to trim them back to make it a little bit easier to transplant, but anything else I should do, I guess, to make this a successful transplant?
How big are they at this point?
Oh, right now they're probably 4 foot.
Oh, okay. I think what I'd probably do is maybe go out and maybe prune out some of the very tallest ones near the base and leave the smaller ones. And then just dig up the plant, and they're not that big, so you can treat them as basically a bare root plant. Just dig them up, and I do that probably around mid-April when the ground has kind of thawed out and firmed up. It's not too wet, and just treat them as a bare root plant and put them right back in the ground. They should be fine. They should be fine.
Mulch the root zone to keep it moist?
Keep them well watered during the spring and early summer. They'll be fine, though, so I would just shoot for around mid-April. And maybe prune back some of the taller stuff back to the ground. You could, if you needed to, take some twine and kind of wrap that around so they're kind of easier to dig up. Treat them as a bare root plant. I don't think you have to dig them up as a bald and burlap plant. I would just dig them up as a bare root plant.
Very fibrous root system. They'll transplant very well.
Yeah.
Another transplant I'm contemplating is moving a hibiscus. That's pretty well established. Any insight on that?
Well, this is a herbaceous plant that dies back to the ground, or a woody plant?
Woody.
It's a woody plant. If it's something like a Rosa Sharon, they leaf out fairly late in the spring. I would probably wait till maybe mid to late April and then dig that up. And I would try to dig that up with a ball of soil around the root system. I wouldn't want that to become a bare root plant. They're a little bit more finicky, and so try to keep a 1 to maybe 2 foot wide diameter root ball around that plant as you move it.
Thanks, Doug. Hope that helps.
Thank you.
We appreciate the call. We'll go next to David in Cedar Rapids. David, welcome to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day. What's your question?
Thank you for taking my call. I just recently moved into an apartment, and I'm looking to put a couple of plants in the place to kind of make it look a little nicer. I didn't have any space for them in before, so just looking for a couple of recommendations. I tend to have a black thumb. I kill everything I touch.
Okay.
So the room that I'm looking to put them in, my living room, it faces northwest. It has a sliding glass door, but I don't get a whole lot of light in through there.
Well, I would start probably with a pothos, which is a vining-type plant, like a philodendron. Very easy to grow. So they hang down. They would kind of cascade down something. They do fine. A peace lily, very, very common, that you can find at most greenhouses. They'll tolerate low levels of light. Okay. So that would be a good choice.
Fairly easy to take care of.
Chinese evergreen, very colorful foliage, very similar to a dumb cane, but it's not as big. So maybe a Chinese evergreen.
Scheffalera.
Okay. Scheffalera would be a possibility. Possibly a fig, a weeping fig. They drop a lot of leaves, so they're kind of messy a little bit, but very easy to find and grow. Possibly a Norfolk Island pine. That's more of an evergreen type. It has these tiered-like branches. So those would be possibilities.
Okay.
And the key thing would be, as far as care, try to find a good location where the plant can stay, where you're not moving it from room to room or place to place, but it can stay there. Now, you may want to rotate the plant in the window, but leave it there. And then give it good, consistent care as far as watering. And typically for most plants, you're going to allow the potting soil surface to dry out, and then you're going to water thoroughly. So if they have a consistent environment as far as lighting and moisture, they can usually adapt to those conditions fairly well. But if the care is very erratic, then it becomes more iffy.
How's that sound, David?
Sounds great to me. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. We appreciate it. We'll go next to Penny in Cedar Falls. Penny, welcome to Horticulture Day with Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron and Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis. What's your question?
Well, I have a cactus that we grew from seed. It's about 2.5 feet tall right now. But the base where it's in the pot is only like 2 inches around, and up about 6 inches. Then it starts to change and gets to about 6, 8, 9 inches tall or around.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to know, is it possible where it's only 2.5 inches around, where it goes up about 6 inches, can I plant that farther into the pot, or should I just leave it the way it is and let it go?
I would leave it the way it is.
Okay.
If you planted it deeper, the base would basically rot.
Oh.
And that's true for many plants. You really can't plant them deeper than they're currently growing. A good exception would be a tomato plant.
Right.
But most other plants you can't do that to, because that buried portion then basically rots. And if that rots, it has no root system, and the plants are basically kind of doomed. What you could do, if you really wanted to, would be to cut it off and root it at that point. But yeah. I'm not sure I would even try that. I would be inclined not to. You could.
Well, I've been growing it for 25 years, and I don't want to cut it off. And you know, I mean, it looks good, but it looks like it's going to fall over at any time because of the smaller base.
And that's true for some cacti, but they're actually kind of amazingly strong and sturdy, and usually they're okay. It's just like some of these big old giant saguaros in Arizona. They have a small base, but they have all those branches that stick up above it, so they're pretty,
yeah, I'm
pretty
strong. Sure that's what this is from the seeds we got, so I have a baby saguaro.
Oh, nice. Thanks, Penny. Good luck with it. We appreciate
you.
It. We'll take one last call here. Rich from Mount Pleasant, what's your question for our remaining moments of Horticulture Day?
Yes, a car came through my front yard and sideswiped a maple tree. That's about a hard maple tree. That's about 20 feet tall and 12 inches in diameter, and left a bumper scar that's about 2 foot on the side of the tree by 6 inches wide. So I wondered, and the tree kind of got tilted 10 inches into the wind. So I wondered what to do with that scar.
The scar itself is not a good thing. The main concern is that because you have a wound, you may have some type of wood decay fungus that may eventually invade the trunk of the tree and cause it to rot. But on the other hand, it's not going to die. That's not going to kill the tree by itself. So it's not a good thing. You really can't do anything to help the tree recover from the damage. Painting it doesn't do any good. Wrapping it doesn't do any good. So you really can't do anything to help the tree. Just make sure that no additional damage occurs to it, where you don't want to hit it with a lawnmower or anything like that and cause, rip off a bigger piece of bark. So just leave it as it is and let the tree deal with the actual damage. If there was some loose bark around the edges that are just kind of hanging there, I would kind of clean up the wound so it looks better. But beyond that, no painting, no wrapping, just leave it as it is.
Okay. Thanks, Rich. Good luck with that. I'm sorry to hear about your maple, but hopefully it'll be all right. It's another hour of a Horticulture Day gone by, but we'll be back next week. And I'd like to thank everyone who called in, and especially those who are taking the questions. Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and extension entomologist Donald Lewis, thanks so much. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our assistant producer is Christoph Bai. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Julie Englander. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back.